I'm going to start by answering four basic questions. Those are the questions that are on the bottom of page one. Essentially, what is a legal fund? How does the billing process work? How does the Attorney General determine the rate? And what is the rate for 2007-09? We'll start with the legal services fund. And essentially, it is a legal fund. What is the legal fund? It's essentially an internal service fund where the revenues and expenditures are recorded. And any operating cash is essentially the ending balance in that fund. As for how the billing process works, it's just like billing process in any other law firm. In order to illustrate our accounts receivable process, as I walk you through the top of the slide at the top of page three, I'm also going to use some dates in my example. So essentially, we might say that a client would walk in on February 5th looking for legal assistance, and work would be performed by DOJ attorneys and staff. Their time spent working on the case would be tracked, and an invoice for time worked would be generated and sent to the client after month end, approximately March 5th in this case. And payment would be received from the client within 30 days on April 5th. With that, I've just run you quickly through that billing process and rate model. I mentioned the dates, again, because of our KPM, that we receive 80% of our accounts receivables within 30 days. So there is a rather, you know, short turnaround between the time the work is performed and the invoice is sent and the cash received for services rendered. Our clients are at the bottom of page three and the top of page four. You've got the state, generally, they're the state government. These are the two different universes. And then you've got internal programs inside DOJ. I want to emphasize that the process isn't any different for billing an internal client within DOJ as it is for any other state agency. For example, if DCS, and of course DCS is going to let contracts, they're going to have their contracts reviewed by the General Counsel Division, as would other state agencies, and the General Counsel will track their time spent reviewing those contracts and bill DCS as they would another state agency. I'm going to speak then to our key performance measure, which you see at the bottom of page four. There it is, with our target of 80%. We're currently achieving 74%. If you'll let me, I want to call that close to target. We're hoping that the switch to the electronic billings, as described yesterday by Frank Pesha, will help close that gap. As to how the Attorney General determines the legal rate, we've laid out this calculation for you at the bottom of page 5, which shows you that it's pretty simple. It is the estimated total cost of providing legal services divided by the total number of billable hours. Costs included in that estimate are direct costs, which are the salaries and services and supplies for the legal divisions. There are central services costs, which are essentially the administration costs, which Frank addressed yesterday. And then there are external fixed costs, the biggest of which is, of course, state government service charges and assessments. Give you a little bit of example of kind of the formula that we would walk through in calculating that estimated cost. At the bottom of page 6, you see that it's pretty straightforward. Essentially, what we're doing is taking the legislatively adopted budget for 2005-07, factoring in changes to LAB for the interim, emergency boards, making an adjustment for updated vacancy rates, and then we've got base changes where personal services are going to roll up from the costs that were necessary to fund those services, personal services in 2005-07, to what it'll cost to fund those positions in 2007-09. And then we've got to factor in other related compensation costs, as in COLAs that are anticipated in the coming biennium, increases in flexible benefits, and adjustments in PERS rates, if any. Finally, we add in policy packages and the effects of those. And the sum of those then equal our new rate And you'll see actually all of these pieces discussed in more detail in the next slide, which is the top of page 7, or I've actually provided you the full blown-up page. That if you can get that, we can actually walk through that in greater detail. We ourselves recognize that we were asking a lot for you to be able to read that. So here it is again, same format, only with some details provided. What I've done literally is start with a 2005-07 legislatively adopted budget. That is the budget out of Orbitz. It's using the state budget system, personal services systems for generating costs. Factored in the emergency boards. That's the primarily the DHS. It is, in fact, just the DHS. Primarily. The DHS package for juvenile dependency that came in the emergency board, this biennium. And then you arrive at the legislatively approved budget for 05-07. And we've got that 111. In fact, it's 111-31 there on the right. That's our starting point. What I'm going to do in the next box are make two changes to that rate. And still, these come right out of states' budgeting systems. We're going to make an adjustment for our FTE. That includes the FTE that's come in from the emergency boards, those positions to work those juvenile dependency cases. And I'm going to make an adjustment to reflect updated calculations for vacancies. Finally, then, I'm going to bring in the roll-up that I spoke of with respect to personal services. That all happens in base budget in our budget systems, and it's happening here to arrive at our new base budget where we need $106 million, or where we have $106 million in expenses. And at this point, that's generating a rate of $125.92. I'm going to factor in the essential packages. It's laid out in the budget instructions. Essentially, you've got inflation and adjustments to state government service charges and assessments. That will bring in another $1.3 million and bring the rate to $127.81. Next are those costs that I spoke of. These are estimates for COLAs. Anticipated increases in flexible benefits as in insurance. We've got a reduction in rate because some of our administrative costs will be assumed by internal DOJ programs through indirect cost allocation. And the last one there of note is the working capital. We've made an adjustment to increase our working capital, reset it back at the 2 months, and yet you'll see an offsetting number there in order to keep the rate, as I'm going to speak to in just a minute here, at the 128. It's essentially the balancer at this point. So now what you've got is base budget, and then it's been adjusted for anticipated costs that aren't yet budgeted. And so that you're fully funding the base positions. You're rolling up the 05-07 programs and funding them for 07-09. And at this point, you've got a rate of 131.53. And the last or major box there, we're making an addition or actually a reduction to our rates by including mandated caseload and policy packages. So mandated caseload are the DCC costs that Mary Williams spoke to, and then our policy packages, the whole bundle of those. You can see they are split out, though, by the two types and what adjustment each of those major categories bring to our rate, the total of which bring our rate down by $3.53. Bringing it down to the 128, and now getting back to the adjustment in working capital price list that was sent out in March of 2006, in which the agencies build their budgets for both attorney general charges and state government service charges and other assessments by other central agencies. This is, in fact, that same rate on which agencies have built their budgets. You might ask, how can we reduce the rate by adding mandated caseload and policy packages? What you see as a cost to state government, and one twist can actually reduce the legal services rate, and it's basically because the back to the math with respect to its estimated total costs divided by the billable hours, and I'm at the top of page 8 now, the basic formula, in the basic formula, the numerator is cost, and the denominator is billable hours. Well, those, the mandated caseload and policy packages, you've got a lot of, we have a lot of billers in those packages, and so essentially the costs aren't as increasing the same rate that the billable hours are, and so it's yielding a lower rate. Another way to look at it is in terms of economy of scale. We now have more positions over which to distribute fixed costs.
The magic number there is the billable hours. Can you explain how you come up with the total possible billable hours? Is that by the number of FTE attorneys?
It is.
Both
attorneys and the other classifications. Yes, Chair Shields and Representative Cameron, the calculation is the number of FTE by classification and then the standard billable hours by classification. So, in fact, there another party in our division spoke to the fact that our attorneys bill 3,200 hours in a biennium.
3,200
hours.
Senator Brown.
Oh, in a biennium. I was like, holy smoke. I was thinking a year. I'm like, oh, my gosh, we should be paying them more.
1,600.
So, yeah, 1,600. Exactly. Okay. Yeah.
It was good, I tell you.
It's a long work week.
We're getting our money's worth.
So at the bottom of page 8, basically, again, this is just reminding you that the governor's recommended budget rate is $128 for the attorneys, as was the price list on which agencies built their budgets. Page 9 basically shows you the average makeup of every state dollar spent on legal services. So for every dollar spent, the average you've got is 49 cents general fund, with the other big player in there, other funds, at 37 cents. Finally, as I mentioned when I started this presentation, I would show you the other classifications for which we bill, and this last chart lists or provides you that information, as well as the rates, and you can see a historical rate for those classifications as well as our attorneys. That, I'll open it up for questions.
Well, I'll ask the rookie question. What happens if we give you a portion of the 128, say, if we went to 125?
Chair Shields, I think that the answer to that is, one, the first place that we would have to reduce would be obviously probably the only answer is our working capital. Because all of these costs will be incurred at least through the 2007-09 essential budget level plus adjustments. Because, again, those are just base positions. So unless you make a reduction to the program, these costs will be incurred, and so the only place where there's room is in our working capital, and it's just essential to have 2 months working capital as we have to make the payments. We have to pay our employees, like you appreciate getting your paychecks, and front that money prior to receiving payment from the paying agencies, the client agencies.
Want to comment on that?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee commenting on the whole thing, our job will be, as we have done in previous years, go through the assumptions and work with the agency in looking at this. In previous years, we've made some major reductions in the rate, but I will warn you, there will not be much this year just because of the nature of the cost drivers in it. We will look at the estimates of the salary increases in the COLAs and the health benefits for 08 and 09 and take a look if they match what DAS and the legislature are looking at, make sure those are assumptions are right. But this is really a cost recovery. And as Karen said, they need to make the payments, whether it's to their staff, whether it's to the assessments, the DAS, whether to pay their rent or whatever it might be. And there's very little variability in what they can adjust in that rate. I know it's a sizable rate. It's roughly 15% from the 111 to the 128. Almost all of that is staff cost-driven, compensation-driven, which the agency does not have a great deal of control over because they're in salary classifications. That 15%, and we're working on making sure we can compare that, is comparable to compensation increases in the rest of the budgets under state government. If you take a look at it, and I'll put together some notes when we work session this to show that. It just is a little more stark here because you're seeing it right in front of you and seeing a number that's understandable, going from $111 to $128. So hopefully we'll be able to show you that. The plan is to work session this a little later and then at the end of the session currently to have one single bill make the changes to the AG lines of every single state agency and not try to work them in at various times like we've done in the past. There'll be other assessment changes, most likely from DAS. In the past, there's been changes to Secretary of State, Library, and a few others. So this will be one of the agenda or one of the assessment changes, and I'm sure the co-chairs will capture any amount of funding that comes out of the savings, and you as a subcommittee unfortunately can't claim any of the savings at this time. They're sort of the property of the co-chairs.
This doesn't help with our 2% thing.
No, it doesn't, unfortunately.
Mr. Chair. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Karen, I just a question on the KPM number 5. The target's 80%, and we were 70, 74, it looks like, in 06. I guess I have two questions. One is these are mostly state agencies that are being billed and paying within 30 days?
Chair Shields, Representative Cameron, correct.
As a person who bills state agencies, that's remarkable to get your money in 30 days. I don't experience that, so curious how you get that done. Second question is, if we were to achieve the target of 80%, what would that allow us to do to our working capital? Would we be able to reduce the working capital if we were meeting that target on receivables or a higher target even?
Chair Shields and Representative Cameron, my answer to that would be that I don't believe it will actually have an effect on it, in that we're essentially calculating the target for working capital based on our projected expenditures. And so essentially I need enough to cover the last 2 months or any 2 months within a biennium in our working capital.
Just to follow up. So why are we putting that at 80%? What does that help the agency if we reach the 80%? And how does that improve efficiencies then? Where would we see it? If it's not in working capital.
Would you like to respond to us in writing in a minute?
Chair Shields, Representative Cameron, I'll take another run at it.
By the way, Karen, how long have you been in this job?
Yes, thank you. About 9 months or less. Budgeting
a little slack.
Half a dozen years, but I'm still rookie with DOJ. I'm gonna actually, if I can, retract.
Okay.
My earlier response, because in fact the other piece of that calculation with respect to noting that I need 2 months worth of working capital is, of course, I'm starting with what's my projected ending balance, and if in fact that ending balance doesn't have that other 6% in there, then yes, it could potentially reduce the need for working capital if we could collect that additional 6% and have that on a regular basis, then I would have less of a need in order to reset it at 2 months.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the working capital is important for a couple, more than a couple, but two primary reasons. Number one is that there'll be a cost of living increase most likely sometime during the 09 or 07-09 biennium. That working capital has to cover that amount depending on when it comes in. That's the same for all state agencies. The difference here is they're generating a rate to generate that revenue. Second of all, the DOJ uses a legal fund. They take loans from the legal fund for other operations in isolated cases. And the best case this time around is what you heard yesterday about the Master Settlement Agreement. The legislature has yet to provide sufficient funding for the 05-07 cost of defending the Master Settlement Agreement. And as a course, they have incurring these charges, and for now they're borrowing from the legal fund until they're reimbursed from the state. And that's probably not the only case that's happened, but it is an internal cash management tool for the agency also.
Any questions? No? Thank you very much, Ms. Preston, for your comments. We appreciate the very well-prepared testimony of the entire department at this point. I'd like to bring Mr. Attorney General Hardy Myers up for any closing remarks.
Thank you, Chair Shields and members. Hardy Myers, Attorney General, and I will be brief because I know you had Director Menace and his budget to begin. First, I'd like to extend very sincere thanks to the subcommittee for its professional treatment of the members of the department. That is always deeply appreciated by my colleagues and me, and I do thank you for that. I think that by far the most important issues the subcommittee will be resolving are the issues presented by the new resource recommendations of the various policy option packages. I think that as a whole, they probably are the most significant group of policy option package recommendations during my tenure as Attorney General. And of course, they arise from different foundations, so to speak. For example, prior underfunding coupled with relentless workload growth, defense of criminal convictions, or a change in federal resources which can impact severely a program like the loss of the federal match for the incentives in the child support program, needs to protect the government's resources, the defense of the Master Settlement Agreement and the MPM proceeding. For the most part, though, the rest of the packages are really proposals to address one or another need within the government for legal services. And all of those packages, as has always been our practice in the department, are included in our agency request budget only with the support of the affected agencies themselves, which doesn't mean that you would necessarily approve them, but it's that we're not here asking for new resources to serve, let's say, the juvenile dependency process without the full support of the Department of Human Services in terms of their seeking the funding for it. So our primary concern, I think, going forward would be to ensure that we have met fully the needs of legislative fiscal office staff, of course, and Mr. Wilson, but also the individual members of the subcommittee for information that you feel you want to help you inform, assess, and inform your judgment about the different policy option packages. And certainly to the extent that there is any specific request for information any of you wishes to send to the department, I assure you we will be responding to that as quickly as we can. And if any of the members of the subcommittee wish personal time with any member of the department to discuss some aspect of the recommended budget, naturally we would be more than happy to try to to cooperate with that as quickly and fully as we can. Again, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great, thank you, Mr. Attorney General. Questions?
Sure.
Senator Brown.
Thanks. Don't want to pass up on this opportunity. Mr. Attorney General, not a quick question, but I know that folks might be looking at the billing rate of $128 as a hugely outrageous sum, and having worked Indigent Defense, that looks really juicy to me as well. But I assume compared to the market billable rate for attorneys, I don't know what attorneys at Stoll Reeves or downtown Salem make. I don't know if you can give us an idea the going rate for a lawyer for an hour in Oregon, in one of the cities in Oregon. Rough estimate.
Chair Shields, Senator Brown, I wonder if I could respond to that in writing to you.
Sure.
I'd like to be sure I've got updated information.
Okay.
It will be significantly higher, I think, than the DOJ rate I could also do is give the subcommittee some examples of the costs of some of our special assistant attorney general contracts, so-called SAG contracts, where usually because there is an expertise we do not have in the department, we will go outside to retain and appoint a special assistant attorney general from the private sector. And I think two or three of those contracts would give you a pretty dramatic illustration of the difference in the hourly costs that the government has to incur in that setting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? All right, thank you very much for a job well done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'll take your 128.
Perhaps you could contract with Representative Cameron.
As I said, I'll take your
128. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5520, Department of Justice budget, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5536, Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. Senator Bennis, if you can come forward with any staff that you would like to present with you. And let's tee it up. Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chairman of the subcommittee, there should be a memo somewhere buried in front of you, as well as a notebook that the agency has brought forward, which is their presentation document. I'll quickly go over parts of my memo as an introduction and turn it over to the agency. On the first page, I'll skip. It's the agency mission and primary programs. The department will cover those. On the second page, budget notes, e-board actions, audit findings. There were two budget notes from last session, both of them requiring a report to the emergency board. The first on completing the 16-week training curriculum and fully implementing the state police recruit training into the DPSSP coursework. That, just note, is starting, I believe, the first class of OSP troopers on campus now?
Right.
Okay. They were close, if not on. The second budget report was rather a long one regarding, again, reporting on the training course, progress on specific curriculum development by the subcommittee last time, some of it dealing with mental health issues, some of it dealing with diversity, cultural awareness issues, and then reporting on some of the move and building project construction costs related items. They did report to the board, I believe it was last September, on those. There was one audit completed relating to DPSST. He had very good things to say, and it was generally on the construction project on the new training facility you'll see tomorrow if you take the tour. If you take a look on the next, at the bottom of that page, some real quick history and revenue sources. Excuse me. The proposed budget is just under $51 million. It primarily has three revenue sources: criminal fines and assessment, the fire insurance premium tax for fire-related training, and then the general fund. All of the general fund, which is roughly $11.3 million, is used for debt service on the COPs on the new facility. The next page has a couple graphs. I will not always do colored graphs, but on this one I needed to on the bottom because of just the way it was structured. The top graph shows you the what I'll call significant growth from 0305 to 0709 GRB, as well as the FTE growth. This growth is primarily due to moving to a new facility and constructing that facility, and then also going to the from the 10-week to the 16-week training course for basic law enforcement training. So you'll see that the growth from 03-05 to 05-07 includes quite a bit of debt service growth at the bottom, which is the yellow. And then moving on to the 07-09 EBL, which is the essential budget level, basically keeping the current level of services from 05-07. And then moving on with program enhancements to the 07-09 governor's recommended budget. The growth between the 05-07 budget and the governor's budget for 07-09, about half of it represents roll-up costs, and the other half includes program enhancements, which the agency will go through, both to the fire program, to the training program, and also to some of the administrative and support functions. Much of the admin support functions in this agency that the color, green color on the bottom graph, a lot of that is lodging, room, and board costs for those folks participating in the training. And then also some administrative functions, but a lot of it is directly related to the training and feeding and housing the recruits that are on campus. Major policy issues on the last page, just a couple worth noting there. The agency has not managed a facility of this size in the past. They had leased facilities at Western Oregon University, so that's a new challenge for them, and you'll see some increases in the governor's recommended budget regarding those challenges. The new 16-week basic training course started at the beginning of this calendar year. The agency will have continuous changes to that program over time, continuous improvement to it, I'm sure. And they have already recognized that and are asking for 16 additional positions related to that training in their budget. There are other training that goes on this campus beyond law enforcement, the sheriffs, the police, the state troopers. All of new folks coming into the correctional department are trained in a basic 5-week class, along with county jailers, there's parole and probation. And some of those other training venue or training professionals occupations are also looking at increasing, if possible, over time their increase. I know there have been some interest from the correctional folks about increasing their 5-week course. And finally, in terms of a major driver, retirements in public safety professions continue, and that will be a major driver for them in the future, depending on the number of those retirements, but needing to bring on new recruits. And I think you've probably seen in the paper recently that some of the agencies are having a trouble recruiting folks for a whole host of reasons. And so that sort of counterbalances that, regardless of the fact that cities, counties, state folks do need public safety professionals, and they do flow through this institution for or this agency for their basic training. As a sidelight, just one last closing comment. Training, generally the training costs themselves are paid by the state, generally through CFAA for the basic law enforcement training, for example, but the local agencies do pay for the salaries of the new recruits while they're in training. They are hired by the agency. For example, police, Salem Police Department, they are then sent, being paid, and sent to the campus or the DPSST training facility, and the locals pay for their salaries while they're in the recruit. The state pays for the actual training costs. So with that, Mr. Chair, those are the beginning topics.
Chair. Yes, Senator Nelson.
Certainly, well, there's the proposal that we add more troopers on. Getting to those, basically those funds are coming from a variety of sources, criminal fine assessment, etc. Will there be a general fund impact upon those if we do the whatever amount of troopers that we're thinking about doing? Might go to the general fund, or will that be charged to the state police, and will that be a pass-through of the state police on their general fund?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, as it stands now, DPSST will pay the training costs for those recruits.
Out of the fines?
out of their funding source, which is basic criminal fines and assessment. There was adjustment made to the state police budget last biennium, a reduction, taking that into account, or probably not a total reduction, but to be honest, the state police training budget had sunk to quite low levels, regardless of the fact, to do all the other training that local police do for their own folks or state police do for their own troopers, the continuing education, whatever it might be.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Public Safety Subcommittee, Ways and Means. My name is John Menace. I'm the Director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. I'd like to introduce the individual to my right. His name is Eric Gadlitz. He is the Deputy Director of the agency. This lady to my left is Linda Gilbert from the Budget Management Department of Administrative Services. And just in case I have to call a friend on technical issues, I have my business director in the audience, Ms. Elaine Sears, who's an extremely competent numbers person. Did I get up against the wall to try to explain something? Mr. Chairman, I want to thank you for the opportunity to come in and share with you this agency's budget presentation. We always seem to like the opportunity to get in front of committees and I think brag about what we're doing and where the agency's going, because it's substantially different than where it has been in the past. I also want to talk just briefly, if I can, because my understanding is some of the members of the committee are going to come out tomorrow afternoon for a tour of the facility. I know several members have already been out, and I want to, again, thank you for the opportunity to have you be hosted there and to see the venues. We do have we've got a limited amount of time that we're going to be able to spend with you because of your schedules, and it's a little bit shorter than the time I think the Judiciary Committees have spent. So we're going to try to focus you on Range 3000, which is a firearm simulator, use of force simulator, and then take you to the venues and show you some of the materials that are out there, as opposed to putting you in a car and driving or actually having you shoot firearms like some of the folks have already done. However, having said that, I want to say that if you do want to come out and you want to drive cars, you want to experience the skid cars or pit exercises, pursuit intervention technique exercises, or emergency vehicle operations driving, or actually firearms training, we're happy to do that on an individual basis if you'd like to come out and see it. We do think it's important. In fact, it underlies the very foundation of why we built what we built and what it's intended to do for us. I also want to introduce who I'll bring up a little bit later. I know our time is short, but I have the Policy Committee Chairman, Mr. Harold Burke Sivers, who is here. He has to give a class, I believe, at Notre Dame on Thursday and cannot be here for that public testimony. So we're going to try to slide him in so he can talk about the Private Security Policy Committee, private investigators, and how he sees or perceives the agency and where we are and some of the needs that they have, if the committee will entertain that. I do want to also mention that we are board-driven in our history. We have started out as the Board of Police Standards and Training, evolved into the Board of Public Safety Standards and Training, and ultimately became the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training as various entities and training venues were added to the department. I've mentioned earlier in a previous presentation our mission. I'll just go over that briefly. It's to promote excellence in public safety by delivering quality training and by developing and upholding professional standards. The vision for the agency's DPSST will be a leader, or the leader, in developing skilled, ethical public safety professionals who are respected in their communities as they work to ensure that Oregonians are safe and secure where they live, go to school, work, and play. And that vision was developed in concert with the governor's principles last biennium when our budget was developed. Again, values for the agency established by the agency itself: integrity, excellence, customer service, respect, accountability, communication, and employee development. I'm going to turn to a tab, and I think you have the same tabs, overview of the programs and budget drivers for the agency. I'll just say that what we've done in our presentation, I don't know if it's different than what you might have experienced before, but we've tried to integrate some overview and then budget drivers into that discussion, and we'll get into some performance measures a little bit later if that's okay with the committee. We have within the academy-based training section of the agency police, corrections, parole and probation, telecommunications, emergency medical dispatch, leadership, police career officer development course, and the corrections career officer development course. Those courses are condensed two-week programs, generally in the area of law, procedural law, criminal law updates for individuals who are either coming back into law enforcement or corrections work, or officers coming from out of state with prior experience that can be documented and show that they've been through a basic program. Within the basic training police course, as was mentioned earlier, we're currently transitioning from our 10-week course to a 16-week course that's been developed over the last several years. And something that's very important is the transition from simple complex or simple scenario-based training or classroom academic training, then adding scenarios to our program, and now evolving to classroom and complex scenario-based training. And that's a very important principle or concept to understand, because our hope is that these scenarios will have a multiple number of branches that will be changed and transitioned by the actors as the individual engaged in the scenario either acts or does not act the way they're expected to act when they're responding to a particular kind of call. Our budget drivers here, and these will repeat themselves throughout. I'll try not to repeat myself, and I'll try to expedite as much as I can. The budget drivers are the realistic and complex scenario-based training. I think I mentioned in the original overview of the agency, where I talked extremely fast, that the brain function, and I'm not a physician, I'm not a scientist, but we do know that research shows that brain function works, that you remember things based on what you see and the impact of that. It has a neurochemical impact on your brain, and you'll remember traumatic incidents. We call them the aw crap scenarios. So when you get punched in the face, it wasn't expected, you're going to probably remember that all of your life. And I'd actually challenge you to just think about, if I say the word elephant or I say the word donkey, that's kind of intentional because the various parties represented here. But if I say that, you will picture that in your mind. You will actually see that, and I would challenge you to you know, try that yourself and have somebody say a word to you and see if you don't see that picture. Well, that basically says that the mind, it does not distinguish between fantasy or reality. So the scenario-based training is very important, because to the extent we can move people through very realistic programs, they will remember these things, and it will become part of their DNA, if you will, in terms of how they think and how they respond and how they act. So it's critical that they get involved in these complex scenario-based training. Other budget driver, the incorporation of Oregon State Police training into the DPSST basic course. Senator Nelson mentioned that. That is something that's been assumed in our budget and is something that is successfully moved into fruition. And we are prepared to accept and train those officers to the extent that those folks begin to be recruited and entered into our program. Aging workforce and succession planning. You know, I don't have the particular materials in front of me that document this per se, but we know that we're all getting a little bit older. I'm one of the last into the baby boomer groups. I'm already retired from the Portland Police Bureau. There are a lot of people like me that have retired and they're going away. And what's challenging public safety careers is that there aren't very many young people who want to go into law enforcement careers. It's fascinating to me, but I'll just cite a couple of issues. You can get this online, or I can get copies of it to you. I presented it last session also, but the National Institute of Justice did a research study on recruitment issues, and they signified a couple of issues that are driving why people are not going into law enforcement. One is a strong economy. We still have a strong economy throughout the nation. I think our unemployment rate in Oregon is about 4.5% or 5%. That's very competitive. Also, increased educational requirements for applicants. You might remember that the Portland Police Bureau under Chief Moose instituted a requirement that 4-year baccalaureate degrees would be required for hire. They backed away from that because they ran into extreme recruitment problems. But that is actually an objective of law enforcement and public safety across the nation, to increase and improve the educational levels of officers. They cite the unusually high attrition rate by baby boomers as they begin to retire. That would be me. And a negative publicity over matters such as racial profiling and excessive force issues that have been throughout the media, and then also increased hiring during the 90s that may have drained the pool of applicants. So it's a very competitive marketplace out there for people that want to come into law enforcement, or they're trying to recruit into law enforcement. The growth in Oregon's population obviously adds some additional stresses to our communities throughout the state, and the demand for effective law enforcement and public safety endeavors throughout the state. Increased demand for training and certification. On this particular point, I just want to mention a couple of things that are foremost in our mind in the organization, actually on a national basis. Again, on the web you can find through the Ethics Institute. The National Ethics Institute did a study with regard to law enforcement public safety careers, and indicates some of the thought processes within public safety careers that are not necessarily very helpful to the career. And I'll just cite a couple. 79% said that the law enforcement code of silence exists and is fairly common throughout the nation. 3% said that they would not report an officer who they witnessed commit a felony crime. 16% that other officers ostracizing them would prevent them from reporting serious misconduct. 52% said that the fact that a code of silence exists does not really bother them. 7% said that feeling empathy and sympathy could cause them to keep quiet about an officer who has committed a felony crime. 24% said that the code of silence is more justified when excessive force involves a suspect who is arrogant or abusive. 46% said that they would not tell on another officer for having sex on duty. 7% said nothing is wrong with lying to prevent another officer from getting in trouble.
Could I ask you to repeat that last statistic about the ones who wouldn't have a problem with officers having sex?
24% said the code of silence is more justified when excessive force involves a suspect who is arrogant or abusive. 46% said that they would not tell on another officer for having sex on duty. 7% said there's nothing wrong with lying to prevent another officer from getting in trouble because the bond of loyalty among officers is so important. 7% said that they would participate in the code of silence if other officers threatened them. 23% that said that they would not tell another officer on another officer for regularly smoking marijuana on duty. 24% said that they would be more likely to participate in a code of silence if their supervisor and the administration treated employees with great disrespect, and 4% said that they would probably ignore seeing another officer steal something if they knew that he or she was going through a divorce or had serious financial problems.
That's non-police.
These are police officers. These are police officers. So it's salient research because it's fairly contemporary, but it also is something that we're fighting within the career. So as we're trying to professionalize and improve our training and have reality training and in complex scenarios so that people respond appropriately, we also have some performance issues and some ethical issues and professional decision-making issues that we also are trying to deal with in the standards certification section of the agency. I'll talk about that a little bit later. Back to budget drivers, the hiring projections for the Oregon State Police and the Portland Police Bureau, two of the largest agencies, make OSP is believed to project hiring of about 139 officers, if I'm recalling the number, assuming that they get funding and that occurs. Portland Police Bureau likewise has been engaged in the long-term recruitment process and have on average about 9 officers in our recruit academies, and they continue to strive to fill vacant positions. I think there's an article in today's paper on, I believe, 20 command staff officers who recently retired in the agency for another reason relevant to their retirement, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there is a problem there. Potential loss of Oregon and California ONC timber funds. It might seem kind of funny that it would be here, but the effect of the loss of those dollars would be that many county sheriffs, rural agencies would not be able to support the current number of deputies working within law enforcement that they currently have. Those officers being fully qualified will obviously be displaced and go to other agencies or move out of state, and that's an issue for us. The opening of the new academy, as mentioned earlier, we have a brand new facility, 338,000 square feet of space, 213 acres, 22 acres of wetland. It's a huge challenge for us, and we're building an entire facilities department, protocols, procedures, and processes to make sure that we're good stewards of all of those issues. The Board of Public Safety Standards and Training in December of 2005 began a strategic planning process, and as soon as they have completed that process, which should be within the next couple of months, the agency itself will begin an internal strategic planning process to carry forward the desires of the board objectives. The Department of Public Safety Standards and Training recently also did a listening tour of 13 various vocations around this, or locations around the state, and received a tremendous amount of information from those individuals, all disciplines, talking about what it is they would like to see the agency deliver regionally within their communities and how they'd like to see us improve on the delivery of our services, not only in terms of the quality of the services, but in the instances of their delivery. The national average of basic police officer training is, this says 20 weeks, it's actually 21.88 weeks based on a 2000 study. Again, in the National Institute of Justice study, they showed roughly 31 weeks of training as the average in 2004, including field training. So basic training plus field training amounted to 31 weeks. In Oregon, by law, they're required to be completed within 18 months of training that they have now 720 hours in the current 16-week academy. Use of force issues continue to be a huge issue for us, and how to manage our training, how to work our training such that it effectively deals with officer decision-making and use of force and under severe stress, and then working with special populations and training, particularly dealing with individuals with mental illness or other kinds of developmental disabilities that are oftentimes in the community, mainstreamed, and sometimes find their way into confrontations or conflict with the police community. And then challenges recruiting, I mentioned that early in the study. If I can, then, if there are no questions, Mr. Chairman.
Real quick, Mr. Minnison, our district, there's been some controversy over police use of tasers, and I was wondering if that's part of your training.
Our agency so far only does a familiarization of taser training. We do not actually sponsor training. I believe that training is local and usually under the auspices of the manufacturer, the taser devices themselves.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, training, basic corrections training is a 5-week training course, and they are also transitioning to scenario-based training, but within the constraints of the 5 weeks that they currently have to at their disposal. There is a strong desire for those folks to continue to improve their training, and they're benefiting, quite frankly, by the development of the 16-week training program and the scenario-based training and the fact that the venues exist and are being developed at our site. One of the budget drivers different here is the Department of Corrections is opening the Deer Ridge Correctional Facility in Jefferson County, and they seem to be on a building pattern, and I don't know when that's going to stop, but every time they open one of these facilities, in particular if it's in a remote community, it's very difficult for the Department of Corrections to recruit and have individuals who are willing to go to work in remote communities. I believe in Lakeview, one of the challenges that DLC had, we actually did a remote basic training program there that we decided we're not going to do that again because we don't think it was very profitable to our agency and we don't think folks learned well. But they had some challenges with respect to recruiting, because if your wife was going to go to work over there or wanted to go to work, or your husband needed to find a job, there were virtually were no places for them to go, and housing was very, very limited. So it's a huge challenge when these facilities open in rural communities. I think all of the other issues there I have mentioned are the local governments being unable to fund jailing staff with the results empty jail beds. And as you know, with the Wapato facility in Multnomah County and other areas, it tends to be a continuing problem. If I can move to parole and probation, they are a 4-week training program with 1 week of additional training for armed officers in parole and probation. It's very interesting that we have different types of parole and probation officers. They're not the same kind of employees around the state. Some are more social service oriented, and some are more enforcement oriented within the discipline. And that is a bit of a concern and something that the policy committee is looking at with respect to where they go. The transition to scenario scenario training and evidence-based practices within law enforcement or public safety. And then, of course, they have an online connection and use of the Department of Corrections AS400 computer system and their probation parole case management system. I believe I've mentioned all of the previous budget drivers with the exception of, well, I think I did. There is an increased demand for training and certification in this field also, in this particular discipline. With respect to training, telecommunications, emergency medical dispatch, this is a 2-week training program with one additional week of training for emergency medical dispatchers. And there is also a transition of this discipline into the basic scenario-based training program. We recently received a donation from the Oregon Emergency Management Agency 9/11 program and Quest Communications in concert, where they have set up a large server within our own server room, and we have the capability of working with OEM for various kinds of exercises and that within the 9/11 system. Budget drivers. This is the last one significant, and that is the higher turnover rate in this industry. It's a very difficult area to work in. I don't know if you've had the opportunity to work as a dispatcher in a public safety environment, but it's high stress, and oftentimes it's out of the line of sight. You don't see them very often, but they're a critical career because oftentimes the ability of these dispatchers to receive information, receive it accurately, and then dispatch the information in a cogent and calm manner under stress oftentimes will make the difference between life or death, because the dispatcher has the ability, hopefully providing information that is both relevant and timely, that will help the officers either stage themselves or approach the situation consistent with known information. There's a turnover rate of plus or minus 20% in this field. Again, high stress and not always well remunerated. In the leadership training program, we have a basic supervision course for individuals transitioning from a street officer to a sergeant or a first-line supervisor position, which is it's a multidisciplinary course. It involves all of the disciplines, police, corrections, 9/11 dispatchers. It is an 80-hour course, but it's 1 week in classroom, and then these individuals will go out and do elective courses with their local supervisors, their sheriff or chief or whoever it is that's supervising their training. We did that to limit our cost and to make it as cost effective as we can for the agency. We also have a middle management program. The target audience, of course, is middle management, lieutenants, and they have 1 week of electives. 2 week. It's a 2 week training program, but the way this is constructed, and Eric's can help me if I've made a mistake here, is that they come in for 1 week, they're given a project, they go back out to their community, they work on the project, and then they come back several weeks or a month or so later, and they report to the class and give a presentation on that that particular project and how they applied the principles that they learned in their actual practice within their agency. The budget drivers are virtually the same. As I've stated before, regional training program deals with perishable skills maintenance. These are mostly in the area of defense tactics or emergency vehicle operations or just flat-out driving skills and the use of firearms, deadly force, or use of force situations. There's also a field training and evaluation program known as FTEP. And this is the program that follows the officers after they graduated from the academy and hopefully ensures through close supervision with a field training officer that the officers are actually able to perform the various tasks that have been enumerated in the field training manual. There are 5 regional offices in the criminal justice section and annually deliver over 400 classes and also reach roughly 6,000 students across the state. And it's pretty varied in terms of the various kind of classes that are being taught or arranged. And there's actually a very high demand for more classes. As I think I said in the initial overview, we are, to a large extent, the primary training agency for most public safety entities around the state, particularly because they have very limited budgets and can't develop and or retain qualified individuals on a full-time basis to manage that kind of training. Standard certification section is the section of the agency that deals with the issues I spoke to earlier with respect to ethics and certification. They deal with the initial entrance of the officer and their qualifications as they come into the academy, and ultimately as they go through the process of graduating from the academy, go through the field training program, ultimately are certified. Within that standard certification section is a professional standards compliance officer. We have one who deals primarily with revocation certifications, denial of certifications, and publishes the ethics bulletin, which the ethics bulletin is probably the most read publication among public safety workers that's disseminated out of our agency, because there are real cases without the names of individuals citing the various conduct and behavior that they engaged in that resulted in the loss of certification. They also maintain our officer records, and by our records retention requirements, officer records are required to be retained for about 75 years, roughly. They are also a certification maintenance standard overseer. There are certification maintenance standards for police officers established by the board in various subject matter areas, firearms, leadership, and so on and so forth. They maintain all of those records. They are also the general trustee of DPSST records, and then oversee the Public Safety Memorial Fund. And the Public Safety Memorial Fund, as you may know, is a fund that was established by the legislature initially to be a bridge funding mechanism for officers' families where officers are killed in the line of duty. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before we leave standards and certification, in addition to listening to your words, I was also glancing at the statistics that you referred to. And I'm not sure what to make of cases opened in 2005 is 206, in 2006 it's 420. That appears to be a significantly higher number, more than double. So at some time, could you give us a short little memo on how to interpret these statistics? What does it mean? Is this something alarming, or it just something circumstantial because of the timing? You know, sometimes it's scheduling and when things are reported, and how this compares to other states. I'd like to understand a little bit more about this, but not take time out from today.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nathan, we will do that. We'll respond to the committee in memorandum form. And I think I can just answer in generally the trend is upward. We'll get more specific details for you. Usually a case is not open unless it's a relatively serious instance. But we'll get actual information to you.
Great. And if you get that to Mr. Wilson, he can describe it.
Thank you. Budget drivers virtually the same. Standard certification, except the caseload increases, I think that were just referred to by Representative Matheson. We are seeing that. I might just mention, by the way, one of the things that we're doing internally to deal with some of the stresses of the workload is we're working with the District Attorney's Association, the Department of Justice, particularly DAs, to get stipulated orders signed by individuals who found themselves in trouble. A stipulated order. You might have read about a recent case where an individual from the Salem Police Department signed a stipulated order upon pleading guilty to a criminal event. And the stipulated order serves really a great purpose for us. It settles the case. We don't have to proceed with a revocation process, and that ultimately ends up in the Supreme Court. The officer has, in essence, waived that opportunity and has agreed not to enter into law enforcement again in the future. And I might also mention that Oregon is a contributor to the National Decertification Database that is maintained by the International Association of Directors of Law Enforcement Standards and Training and funded by the Department of Justice. And there, I believe, are about 30 states in the United States that participate in that, and they're trying to get more because officers who are decertified in one state tend to migrate to another area. And sadly, many agencies do not conduct thorough background investigations during their recruitment processes and oftentimes will not contact another state and find that the officers found themselves in a lot of trouble and has left simply because they couldn't work as a police officer or corrections officer in that particular state. If I could, I want to move to private security program, and I will cover this briefly, and then I'd like to ask Mr. Harold Burke-Sivers to come up and speak. This is the section of the agency that deals with the licensing of private security professionals and private investigators. Private investigators were added by virtue of statute passed last session, abolishing the Board of Investigators and then integrating that particular function in the Private Security Policy Committee within the agency. There is also legislation this session that will try to line up the statutes that were not lined up very artfully during the last session and hopefully mitigate some of the problems that have resulted. They also license private security managers and deal with the professional standards compliance. They also have a standards and certification section of private security that does much the same work as does our standards certification section dealing with certified police officers. And, of course, deal with certification of instructors who are able to teach courses for private security around both in Oregon and actually around the nation. The budget drivers here, growth in Oregon's population, strategic planning process, and, of course, the DPSST listening tour brought many people from private investigator backgrounds and private security in to tell us that we need to improve and that we need to hopefully provide more training, more access to training, and that there's a strong desire on their professional side to improve and increase what we're able to do for them. If I can, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'd bring Mr. Harold Burke-Sivers up to speak.
Colleagues B, nice to Mr. Burke-Sivers. He's a constituent of mine, and we're very pleased to have you in front of the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I thank you for this opportunity to speak since I will not be here on Thursday. First of all, let me say that almost 11 years ago, the members of the private security community wanted to partnership with DPSST in order to professionalize our officers and attempt to professionalize our industry. Now, this was 6 years prior to 9/11. Since 9/11, You see many states now scrambling to develop these types of partnerships that we had the foresight 6 years prior to be able to put into place. Some of you are very familiar to me because I've testified a number of times over the years with regard to this legislation. And yes.
Please introduce yourself for the record
Sorry. For the record, Harold Burke Sivers. I'm chair of the Private Security and Investigators Policy Committee, and I'm also a member of the board of Department of Public Safety Standards and Training.
Thank you.
Thank you. We represent a number of constituents throughout the state of Oregon in private security, armed and unarmed private security providers, hospitality and service industry, the hospitals, retail industry, alarm monitors, manufacturing, private business and governmental entities. We also have a private citizen constituent, and most recently our private investigators have become part of our policy committee. One of the things that we've done when I became chair is I wanted more of our constituents involved in the process, to not just pick up a telephone and call somebody, but to see us. And so what we've done, we've moved our policy committee meetings around the state. So we have one meeting in the Portland area, one in the Eugene area, one in Salem area, one in Southern Oregon, Medford area, and one in the Bend area, to get more of our constituents to be part of the process. And then one at the coast as well, in the January meeting that DPSST has at the coast, we also have hold a meeting out there as well. One of the things that we've seen is that, for example, police officers have come to me and have said that they've noticed the professionalism of the private security officers, which is definitely one of the goals that we wanted to achieve. Again, since 9/11, many states have been envying us. Honestly, I just got a call from Minnesota not too long ago, who are looking to develop the type of partnerships that we have in this state between agencies like DPSST and the private industry. I think it's been a wonderful partnership and very beneficial. For example, last session, I went to the staff and asked them to create more efficiencies in the way we do business. Unlike many of the other entities, most of our constituents are private businesses. And so they understand, have a different idea of how business should be done as opposed to government. I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but they have a different model. So I asked them for some efficiencies to be created. Well, we were so efficient that we ended up with a surplus, which then caused us to reduce the fees that we charge to our constituents. So those are the types of things that that are benefiting from this partnership. One thing I just want to point out in the KMA analysis for private security, there's two pages on pages 11 and 12. You'll notice that the target that they have for the customer satisfaction rating is between 80 and 85%, and that the actual numbers are quite low, between 55 and 47%. And the reason for that is really quite simple to explain. There are many companies out there who are complying with the statutes, who realize that this is a good thing and are coming into compliance, but they're noticing that there are many other companies out there that are not complying with the statute. And so when they notice, we have one investigator that covers complaints of people not being properly, or officers not being properly certified, but we have one investigator for the entire state. And so the one person, obviously there's a backlog, and so the perception is that not enough is being done to enforce this. And so you see those low ratings. But if you turn the page to page 12, you'll notice the increasing satisfaction for professionalism amongst the officers themselves. That is a direct result of the partnership and the training initiatives and listening to our constituents and responding to their needs for increased and better training. We have responded to that, and we will continue to respond to that. And that's why those numbers are going up, but yet the numbers for the overall industry are staying relatively low and flat because, again, the members of the industry are noticing that some of us are complying, but some are not, and what about them? So that's something that we want to address. And just finally, as we've been moving our meetings around the state, we've been listening to our constituents. Their biggest complaint is actually not with the statute. They're very pleased about the statute. Their biggest complaint is about how long it takes things to get done. And we just don't want to use the excuse, well, it's just government. That's how the way government works. These are business people. They don't want to hear that. One of the things that they've said is, can we automate some of these processes? You know, is there a way we can do things online instead of working by mail? And so that's one of the things that we've looked at in our strategic planning, which Mr. Minister talked about, was how can we automate things and create even more efficiencies so we can better serve. We have over 14,000 security officers now, so it's quite a few constituents. I think two or three times as many as there are police officers in the state now, and we do want to meet their needs and continue this partnership. And I just want to again thank you for this opportunity. I'll take any questions that you may have.
Representative Dickinson.
When I look at the number of newly certified officers on the page for private security program, and there's a significant increase, 2759 to in 2006, 3543, and I start thinking about how many more, how much the work you have to do is increasing. And I think about the reasons for that. In part, I get curious because we see certain kinds of crime, the rate is actually decreasing. But, of course, there's an absolute increase in population, so an absolute increase in certain kinds of incidents or activities. But I wonder if also sometimes this might be attributed, at least in part, to inadequate professional services from city and county as well as state. In other words, officers that we normally would call, you know, the city cops, the county sheriffs, the state police. If we don't have enough funding there, and I can tell you in my town and even in my neighborhood what happens when the DA says he's not prosecuting property crimes anymore and the cops can't respond even to take reports, then you have people who can afford, perhaps, to pay. You start ordering private security services. Is that accounting for some of the growth?
Yes, Chair Shields, Representative Nathanson, I think you hit on a very important point. Yes, especially since 9/11 now, and we've seen a lot of private municipalities and government entities contracting with private security providers, golf courses, neighborhoods, like you said, for example, alarm response. Some police officers are not responding to home alarms. They've subcontracted that out to private security providers. Many government entities are also, as you correctly stated, are outsourcing some of their responsibilities to these private security providers. And so that partnership becomes very essential. And yes, I think again because of Senator, Mr. Minnis, Mr. Minnis discussed the number of police officers is dropping, and so they're looking for better ways that they can still continue to create safe environments for all of the people in our communities, and they see the partnership with private security as at least a stopgap measure for now until we can get more police officers trained, and so we're definitely seeing that upward trend of private security providers filling in certain roles that police officers have traditionally done. Yes.
Thank you.
I just wanted to make a comment about the listening tours. I look at the places that you've been, it seems obvious that you're trying to break out of the Willamette Valley to have some of those meetings, but as you know, police training and police accountability issues are big in our district, and I would just welcome DPSST to hold a listening tour in North Northeast Portland at some point.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, it's a very good suggestion. I believe the particular listening tour we had during the cycle was, I think, in Beaverton.
Gresham, and we did one in Beaverton and one in Alloa.
All right, but actually, your suggestion to come into the inner city is probably a good idea. I'd like to do that. If I can then switch over to the fire training certification program. One of the things, and I'm going to kind of do an interactive thing here with Eric, because Eric is a firefighter and also a telecommunicator and teaches in the telecommunications class, is one of the benefits of having certified individuals in various disciplines who are part of the organization. I understand the cop world pretty good. He understands fire and some other disciplines that are related. But the fire certification program is a voluntary certification program, unlike the other disciplines. The other disciplines, you're required to be certified, can't practice in that area, cannot be working in that field without the certification agency. So it's a licensed certification, like a teacher's license. licensed to teach or licensed to practice medicine or law or something of this nature in that format.
John, can you turn the microphone?
Yes, I can. I'm sorry. I do apologize. And again, I'm John Menace, the director of the department. These standards are developed through national fire organizations and have been adopted by the Agency Fire Policy Council, which are consistent with the national standards for fire safety training and fire training throughout the country. I want to mention there are roughly 10,000 career and volunteer firefighters throughout Oregon. And on average, there are about 4,000 certifications issued, and they train approximately 5,000 students, and they have five regional offices around the state for fire training in addition to the five regional training for criminal justice. Excuse me, kind of stumbling over my words here, but if I go down to budget drivers, one of the ones I want to draw your attention to is the fact that 80% of Oregon firefighters and fire service individuals are volunteers. They're individuals who seek professional accreditation and certification and want training, but they are volunteers. Many of them work in other fields and or businesses around rural Oregon. There's increased demand, again, for training and certification. So this particular discipline has really embraced the idea of additional training and certification, and the policy committee has most recently begun talking about advancing and improving their training, and there's some discussion about future development of an actual fire academy within the state system, like some other states have on campus. There are the implementation of mobile burning props and other kinds of props that we've purchased and are being deployed or will be received by the agency that were approved in the last biennium and will be deployed throughout the state that will help in enhance fire training. Also, the fire service, they're looking at the design and what we built out here at our new facility because it's really envisioned to bring fire service training to that local jurisdiction. Much of the expense of the facility had to do with having heavy lift roads that allow these large apparatus to come out and actually drive down the streets and get out on the emergency vehicle operations training course and the pad, and then also the fire tower that some of you may have seen or you'll see perhaps tomorrow will allow for this fire training where they do various smoke exercises and of course, extinguishing various kind of fires and different kinds of props are within the building. And then, of course, the fire service, the Governor's Fire Service Policy Council, Code 3 Driving Report. This is the one I want to flip to Eric's because, again, he's a firefighter. He actually is a firefighter with the Dallas Fire Department as a volunteer and can speak to the issue of driving habits of firefighters.
Thank you. Chair Shields, members of the committee, for record, Eric Gablix, Deputy Director for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. I'll make this a very quick report on really about a year project which was undertaken by the Governor's Fire Service Policy Council. One of the things that we had seen in Oregon as well as across the country are the number of accidents involving firefighters either responding to emergencies or in some cases responding to or from the fire station because 80% are volunteer. The best example I can give you is imagine a local community where a person drives a Toyota pickup truck to the fire station for a call and maybe 21 or 22 years of age and then gets behind the wheel of a multi-ton emergency vehicle that has lights and sirens and a crew of people that's going to go to a call. That's what happens every day in not only Oregon but across the country. And that is basically what protects most of our rural communities and really not that far off the I-5 corridor where we have volunteer fire departments. The Code 3 Driving report from the from the Governor's Fire Policy Council identified a number of training-related issues, if you will. And one of those is that as a state, we don't really have a vehicle to deliver Code 3 driver training for firefighters. So what we have requested through the Governor's approval process that you'll see here is actually two additional staff dedicated to Code 3 driving for firefighters, as well as a mobile training prop for firefighter driver training, which will allow us to simulate emergency vehicle driving in local communities, which doesn't exist right now. So really where the driver training occurs right now is on local community streets. Of course, they don't start with Code 3 driving, but that's the way people learn how to drive emergency vehicles is on the streets of communities. So as Director Minnis mentioned, the new driving course at the Academy allows us to have a venue where we can do that training in a controlled environment that is not open to the public. It is a closed course, but that doesn't really help somebody from Bend or Eastern Oregon where they don't have the ability to come over here. So we're really exporting training out to them. So that's really what that program does, and I can answer additional questions if you like offline.
One of the other budget drivers I want to mention with respect to fire service is the growth and stability of the fire insurance premium tax fund. A number of sessions ago, the legislature passed legislation that stabilized that funding source, and it appears that it is growing, and it's a healthy fund. This has been brought to the attention of folks working in fire safety, and again, they're very desirous of looking at that fund as a stream of revenue that can enhance funding training of fire service professionals within Oregon and in particular in rural areas where there's a substantial need for that to occur. I do want to also just kind of drop a note in the thinking here, too, with respect to all public safety workers. If a police officer shows up at your door, or a firefighter shows up at your door, or you call 911, most of us have what I call the assumption of competency. Most of us assume that the police officer is competent and capable in a multiplicity of areas of knowledge, experience, and background is going to be able to solve the problem for you. And so there's a huge demand for them to be able to de-escalate a situation or use their firearm, use some intermediary approach to force, et cetera, et cetera. And those competencies and skills generally don't stay at a professional level without the ongoing maintenance training. And same thing with firefighters. If you're a firefighter and you haven't been around a fire in a long time, interestingly, by statute, and I'm the fire chief for our agency, I wouldn't know how to put a fire out except maybe with baking soda and a little bit of water, and I'd probably be confused about which one to put out. So I hang around with these guys real close because the discipline is relatively complex, and it does require an intense amount of study and training and practice in order to be competent and not hurt yourself or others. I can now switch to the facilities section. I alluded to it earlier. That is the fact that we have 213 acres of property with about 22 acres of wetland, that requires environmental stewardship. We have over 300,000, roughly 338,000 square feet of building space that requires maintenance for repairs. Also, our facilities staff, you look at the construct of who we've hired and who we brought on staff, we've done so intentionally, having brought on an electrician, a plumber, and a carpenter. Our idea is that within the confines of the training venues where we have the props, that these individuals will be able to build various props for us on site and movable walls and things of these natures, almost like a movie studio would be able to build props and paint them and prepare them so that they can be moved around so that it's not always the same venue or the same scenario or the same situation that an officer might be encountering or a firefighter encountering as they're going through an exercise. In addition to that, of course, you've got all the various lawns and the maintenance of the roofing and other thing, interesting issues that go along with buildings kind of falling apart on their own. The budget drivers here, of course, New Academy. The warranties for equipment, we have kept Hoffman Construction on. They're now getting ready to separate from us, but one of the benefits has been the ability of Hoffman Construction to work with subcontractors to get warranty work done. That warranty work and the oversight of warranty work is now transitioning to this facilities department. We have a sneaking suspicion it might be a little bit more difficult to get a subcontractor to show up and fix something once Hoffman's out of the picture. And that may present some challenges, and it's time sensitive because those warranties only go on for about a year, and then that responsibility for those various materials fall to the agency. Contract services, we have Aramark as our food service contractor, custodial service, and security services are through Garten Industries, which are rehabilitation services within the state system, we're required to use those particular vendors, and they're all doing a good job, but they also bring challenges to the agency and our ability to manage those issues, make sure that food service is at a quality that's high enough to meet the expectations of our constituents and that it's also being operated safely and efficiently, and that they're providing nutritious food because the environment out there is pretty taxing in terms of your physical requirements, and we want to make sure that they get the right kind of balanced nutrition and food when they're eating. Custodial services. The new building, when you walk out there and take a look at it, there's a lot of glass. Architects like glass. They like they like structure, and to them it's a thing of beauty. To us it's a maintenance nightmare. And to be quite honest with you, it's just when the light shines down from a particular angle, you look up, you say, oh my gosh, the windows are filthy. Well, they were washed 2 weeks ago. And that's going to be a continuing challenge for us to try to deal with those issues, to maintain a proper and appropriate professional presentation, but at the same time keep our budget maintained and not go overboard. Wetlands monitoring, I mentioned that. We are not unlike any other organization or entity. We do actually have to comply with other state agencies and regulations and mandates for wetlands mitigation and all of the propagation of the various plants that have been planted out there, and there are literally thousands and thousands of plants that have been planted there. In order to establish those 22 acres of wetlands, all have to be maintained, and we have wetlands monitoring reports that have to be submitted to the appropriate agencies to make sure that we are, in fact, doing that. Environmental stewardship, I think I mentioned in a previous overview, our ranges are not, they're unleaded ranges. We use frangible ammunition, which are made out of a composite substance, and, of course, the various fluids that we use to clean the weapons are theoretically stuff that you can drink, but we haven't tried yet. But all of those things are they do present challenges for facilities. We have maintained a relationship with military department in Camp Adair, which is where our former range was at, thinking that we will need some kind of a backup in the event that for some unforeseen circumstance the ranges are not available. We can move students to Camp Adair, have that facility up and running, and use it for training. And we can also use that training facility for additional
That's fine. If you can finish up on energy conservation, then we're going to have to adjourn.
Oh, yes. Yes, sir. Thank you.
You remember how that goes.
Yes, sir, I do. When the chairman says adjourn, we adjourn. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Energy conservation, again, this is an area where we entered into an agreement with the State Office of Energy to manage and oversee our energy consumption and use. In the construction of the facility, we have a subsequent visit by the Department of Energy that will be in this next biennium, where they're going to come out and analyze our energy consumption and use and give us some advice for how we can further improve our stewardship over energy conservation. But again, presents a challenge to us. And an example of that was where different air conditioning units, for some reason, were popping on and off. The contractors set them at a particular time, and our maintenance people have got to go through and make sure that they're all coordinated. And they're also trying to do some very unique things, and that is phase the timing of these various apparatus going on so that they are phased over different time frames when the energy costs are actually less. Because if you light up your entire house in the middle at noon, the cost for the energy is much higher. So if we can utilize these things and phase them in terms of how they're being used, we can reduce our energy consumption. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I thank you very much. I hope the presentation met your expectations. We'll be back.
Craig, we will see you, tomorrow we're going to have the tour.
2:45?
Details, 2:45 in front of the Capitol will be a van, and then I think you're back between 4:30 and 5 back at the Capitol. So please be there.
I won't be going tomorrow because we just did it on the bus right away.
Same with Cameron.
Yeah, I probably won't go either, although I'd love to see the simulator. I'll take a rain check on
it. Yes, but I'm going to check to see when I have to be back.
Okay, got at least three. So
excellent.
And then, just in closing, as you know, every biennium we often have to bring in a new prison online, and probably some of the costs that we haven't thought about is the additional training of staff. And fortunately, this time we can take a deep breath, and we're not going to have to build a prison in this biennium. But when you come back tomorrow, if you could share with us what that cost per corrections officer is to get trained, that would be helpful.
You want that with or without debt service?
Your debt service or their debt service?
No, our debt service.
With your debt service and administration. Anything else, Ms. Wilson? This meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.